Hello everyone, and welcome to the Transverse Myelitis Association's Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's podcast is entitled, Managing Your Health After a Rare Neuroimmune Diagnosis. My name is Sam Hughes from the CONQUER program at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, Texas, and I will be moderating this podcast today. The TMA is a nonprofit organization focused on the support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune disorders. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website for download via iTunes. During the call, if you have any additional questions, you can send a message through the chat option available with GoToWebinar. For today's podcast, we are pleased to be joined by Paula Hardiman and Catherine Treadaway. Paula Hardiman is a physician assistant and the lead advanced practice provider in the neuroimmunology program at UT Southwestern Medical Center. After completing PA school, she worked in a primary care office where she was able to implement many programs to help patients learn about and better manage their chronic diseases such as diabetes, high blood pressure, and asthma. In 2010, Paula joined the neuroimmunology team at UT Southwestern. Not only is she involved in the evaluation and treatment of patients with demyelinating disorders, she also develops and coordinates various research projects and health and wellness programs. Catherine Treadaway received her bachelor's degree in sociology and master of social work at Louisiana State University. Catherine has been at the neuroimmunology program at UT Southwestern Medical Center since 2002. She works with a dynamic multidisciplinary team in both the adult and pediatric clinics, participating in research and patient care. She assists patients by serving as their advocate, locating resources, providing counseling, support, and information, and arranging home and outpatient care. Welcome, and thank you both for joining us today. We got a number of questions coming in on this topic, and a number of them kind of fit into some categories. So I'm going to kind of lump them together, and we can kind of go point by point. So first, there were a number of questions that came in that kind of had to do with managing physical therapy after one of these disorders. So the first question we'll start off with is, I've been exercising and doing physical therapy since my diagnosis 2 years ago and have regained a fair amount of strength. If I cut back on my exercise program, is my muscle strength likely to decline to where it was? So basically, what can we expect in terms of long-term physical therapy needs after one of these diagnoses?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And so I'll kind of start off with saying, if you're a person who was in high school and you were an athlete and you were accustomed to running 3 and 5 miles a day, and you've graduated and life work situations have occurred and you're not running as much, when you try to go out and run that 3 to 5 miles, I bet it's pretty difficult. So the same happens with post-transverse myelitis or any of the rare conditions. If you've been working with physical therapy, they're doing certain trainings to help rehab and get you stronger. And then what becomes necessary is to be able to maintain your function. You will need to do some form of exercises, whether it be stretching or different yoga or actually strength training to help be able to maintain function. The difficult part or the tricky part is that this is going to be different for each patient. Some patients will be able to find a regimen where they may only need to do exercises 3 to 4 times a week. Some patients may realize that they need to do something daily. So it depends on where some of your deficits are and the function that you're trying to maintain.
Yes, I would just add on that exercise is really key for maintaining your emotional health as well, because exercise, it has been shown to help cognitive function, to help reduce fatigue, reduce depression, anxiety. So for your physical strength as well, just an overall sense of well-being, I think exercise is really important. And I know for some of our patients, we've had to write letters to advocate for more physical therapy for them, because there can be improvements many years after the event even. So your physician may need to get involved in helping advocate for you with the insurance company.
I'm glad you brought that up, Catherine. There's actually a question that came in relatively late yesterday that had to do with, or at least a part of it was talking about anxiety that they're experiencing along with their tiredness and fatigue and everything, asking if that's normal and what they can do about that. So I'm glad you touched on that. Is there anything you'd like to expand on that in terms of kind of anxiety and depression in the context of ongoing concerns post-transverse myelitis or any of these disorders?
Sure. I mean, I think that those are normal feelings, and just understanding that emotional changes can happen at any time during your journey. It may not be directly after the event of what's happened. It could happen at some other time with a chronic illness. And I would just encourage people to educate themselves and be open with others about their feelings and fears, because the more you know, the less fearful it is. And that way you can base your reactions on fact rather than your worst fears. And there's a lot of things that I suggest as far as decreasing anxiety. And there's a lot of strategies you can use, including guided imagery, meditation, mindfulness, deep breathing exercises, massage, even using essential oils can be relaxing. And I just encourage people to really explore what works for them. There's this really cool app. It's called Calm, C-A-L-M. They have a bunch of meditation exercises, mindfulness. They even have sleep stories to help you go to sleep. They even have ones for children. And a lot of the stuff on their app is free. But you can just explore. There's so much imagery and things out there that you can use. And, of course, again, exercise and yoga can be using a lot of your mind and body strength. So that can be really relaxing. And I just say practice, because practice makes habits. And then habits just become part of your regular routine. Some people may want to reach out for prayer or to a spiritual leader. That might help bring some calmness. But all of those things, I think just focusing on the lifestyle changes that you can control. And I think when people are hit with a chronic illness or have one of these, have transdermal myelitis or NMO, one of the first things to go for the family is enjoyable activities. You know, recreation goes to the side, and I would encourage people to not let that go to the side, because doing those activities does reduce stress. It refreshes your spirits, contributes to your overall health, and those things might be just hanging out with friends, having a date night with your partner, family night. Some people escape with music or art, and I just encourage people to find that place where the transverse myelitis doesn't touch, the ADEM doesn't touch. You know, find your illness-free zone, where it's just you and your loved ones.
And there, of course, there are different medications that patients can talk to their healthcare provider about taking to help with some of the depression and anxiety that can come along with these various diagnoses. Catherine is completely right. You don't necessarily have to have the anxiety or depression occur immediately after the event. They can occur later on. And so I always encourage my patients to think about prior to the diagnosis, if you were worried about something or if you were stressed at work, what type of symptoms did you have? And most will voice that they had muscle spasms, or they had headache, or they could tell they felt stiff. So now moving forward, you have this rare neurologic event that can also cause muscle stiffness, muscle spasms, maybe even cause you to have a headache and not feel good. Combine that with the natural stressors the body goes through when we are stressed, and that can help you to realize that when you get stressed or when you get depressed or when you get anxious, that could further exacerbate your TM, NMO, or ADEM symptoms. And so it's very important to work on different coping mechanisms, whether it's some of the different strategies that Catherine discussed, or sometimes some patients may need certain medications to help them as well. And so please talk to your healthcare provider about that to see if there's any options going down the medication route.
That brings up a good thing that Paul is just saying. Talk with your medical team. I mean, talk about sensitive subjects that might be depression or cognitive changes or sexual dysfunction. Please talk to us. And if you do feel like your problems and worries are getting the best of you, seek out some help from a therapist. I think some people think of this as a sign of weakness, but I think of it as a sign of strength because you are empowering yourself to do the best that you can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is important to remember. And like you both just put together, the connection between cognitive and emotional symptoms and physical symptoms are really very related. And being able to work with your care team to identify solutions to help one or the other can potentially affect the other. I was wondering, Paula, you might be able to help out with this question. Of course, talking about fatigue and anxiety and all of these kinds of things, these diagnoses and the events that lead to these diagnoses can be very stressful and add to these normal stress. But how much of this these disorders can lead to more of an organic reason for these conditions? So, for example, there's a specific question that came in talking about fatigue, that they were diagnosed with TM and have suffered with fatigue, and they've just had some blood tests done, and one showed that their cortisol level was very high. Would this be a symptom of TM, and how do I go about managing my fatigue? And so when I see that, I think of high cortisol levels and think of a lot of different issues that could come from that. Could you maybe speak to what that would mean for one and if that could be a part of the disease process?
Sure. So it's a little complex. I'm going to start off with kind of just a basic in this particular example. So the simple answer is no. So having TM did not affect that patient's cortisol levels. But what could affect it if the patient was treated with steroids at any time. So different medications that may be used to help control the TM or work on some of the symptomatic management could cause certain blood tests to be abnormal and then creating a new symptom. So this is one of the things you have to really talk about with your healthcare provider when you're discussing various medications to go on. What are the potential side effects and how is that going to affect your day-to-day functioning? How is that going to affect your other internal organs? So you have to remember, medicines can affect your liver, can affect your kidneys, can affect your hormone levels, which can all lead to you maybe feeling fatigued or might make you feel like you're having palpitations or can make you feel like you're nauseated. So it's important to have a clear understanding of different medications and how they impact the body. But I also think this question brings up a good point of what I always want my patients to realize is that your TM, your NMO, or your ADIM is not always going to be the cause of your current symptom you're having. So for instance, with fatigue, there are a lot of other causes, whether it's adrenal causes, whether it's endocrinology causes, meaning your thyroid, or whether it's diabetes. But there's a whole host of other different disease states that can cause fatigue. So sometimes your symptoms may not be truly related to your transverse myelitis or your NMO or your ADIM. And this is why it's very, very important to talk to your healthcare provider and have a good internist who's going to communicate with your neurologist so they can help decipher is something more neurologic related or is there something else going on with the internal organs that we all have.
Yeah, I think that's important to note. And there's another question that came up asking about stiffness and pain and moving and long-term care for that. So basically, they had the TM when they were 35 and they're now 58. And within the last 3 years, stiffness and pain have increased. And so I'm wondering if maybe you can speak to, when you have an event and you're years out from it and you're aging, how the interplay of dealing with symptoms post TM or NMO or one of these diagnoses, especially if it's a one-time event, how to manage that with the natural aging process, and how do you flesh that out as a provider?
It's very tricky to flesh out because as we all age, things are going to not work as well. In which tricky with some of these disorders, they're a progressive disorder, so you expect to see a little bit of progression of symptoms. Unfortunately, with these disorders being rare, it's hard for us as providers to have true evidence to be able to predict what the progression could look like in these different patient populations. So with that said, I think what the podcast participants are going to realize, there's an underlying theme of discussing these different things with your healthcare provider, and they will be able to give you some insight on, is there just certain natural aging to occur? For instance, I hear with my patients frequently that they're starting to have knee pain. Probably if there are some gait mechanics from the TM or NMO or ADIM that can affect your cartilage and other support ligaments in the knee and cause you to have knee pain, but it may be also some aging factors in there too, arthritis. So we're all going to get a little bit of arthritis as we age, which could be causing more of the pain and not necessarily the neurologic condition that the patient may have. But there are some different tests that can be done, especially if we're looking for bone degenerative changes. So simple x-rays will be able to give insight. Is it more of a musculoskeletal, so just the bones having their normal wear and tear, or is there probably some impact of the neurologic condition causing a little bit more of the aches and pains that we can experience as we age?
Sounds like that touches on kind of the physical therapy aspect of things. If there's a problem with the gait mechanics because of the nervous system injury, that's not being managed well from a physical therapy standpoint, then it can lead to worse problems down the line. Is that a good summary of that?
No, that is a very, very good summary. And so it is very important, even if you feel your gait is normal after your event, I think it's very important to go work with a physical therapist who's trained in various gait disorders, because you could be doing a little bit of bad stuff while you're walking to accommodate that you don't even realize for a weakness that you have. And fast forward of doing that 5-10 years down the road, and you're starting to put a unnatural wear and tear on your bones, which is going to further lead to other problems that you can have, the low back hurting or your hips start to hurt. And so the physical therapy is a good way to help prevent some of these other wear and tear activities that can occur.
Mm-hmm. I would just like to add to that I would seek out a physical therapist who has neurology experience, because a lot of physical therapists are trained more on the orthopedic side. So we're very lucky here. We have many neurology-trained physical therapists, but I would look for that. And just like Paul is saying, one of our physical therapists used to tell me, please send people to me as early as possible, even when there's no issues. So they, just like Paul was saying, be sure that you're not compromising and wearing and tearing some other part of your body that you're not aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it touches on the concept of preventive medicine, right? Which is something that we as individuals, when we're sick or when we are dealing with something, we don't necessarily think about the long-term effects of something that's going on right now. We're concerned with the right now. But if we can, especially with these long-term or chronic illnesses, we need to remember that it's important to focus some time on preventive care in order to minimize whatever longer-term issues might come up just because of, you know, the addition of natural aging or all of this. I think that's a very important point that you two make.
Well, and another thing that Paul and I were talking about the other day is just how important it is to build your medical team, have a primary care physician that's kind of coordinating and helping you with all your care, have your specialist as well. If you can be in a university setting, you know, we're able to look at each other's information on the computer. It may not be as easy in other places, but I think building up that team is going to just make you so much stronger, because it's a lot easier to be enthusiastic as a team than being alone.
Yeah, that's so true, and it's so needed, because there's so many different specialties, and it does take a team to manage patients with chronic conditions. And so I look at it, the patient as being the quarterback of the team, and they need to develop the other members, and with it being a primary care, a neurologist, maybe a physical therapist or occupational therapist, depending on what deficits they may have. Sometimes your other team members might need to include a neuropsychologist if there's certain cognitive issues occurring, a social worker or a psychologist if there's problems with anxiety or depression. And all these members of your team should come together and discuss potential ways to help keep the patient functioning or maintaining their current level of functioning.
I think that's an go on, Catherine.
Well, I was just going to throw out there, just in maintaining function for people who are out there working, part of their team, they may want to investigate who their state vocational rehab program is. Like here in Texas, ours just moved under the Texas Workforce Commission. It's Texas Workforce Solutions. But every state should have their own vocational rehab program where somebody can call in, work with a vocational rehab counselor, and open a case. If you're having difficulties at work, they are there to help people who have impairments or disabilities to keep working. And they can educate people about the ADA laws, what kind of accommodations can be asked for. And there is a really great website and resource for patients who are working. It's called the Job Accommodation Network. It's through the Department of Labor, and they give all these examples of accommodations to work with your employer, and it even helps physicians write letters of accommodation, or the patient could call in and just find out, you know, this is what's going on at my work, what do you suggest? And they have legal professionals there at that organization. And I would encourage people, if they have been at their employer for over a year, see if they're eligible for family medical leave, just to have that protection in place for intermittent leave when they need to go to their appointments, when they need to go get imaging done or labs and things that come up, and just have that, or having just a really bad day, to just have that protection through the government, basically. It's a federal law, so.
Mm.
And that's FMLA, yeah. Family Medical Leave Act.
Yeah, it's important to know your resources. At the end of the day, we as providers can do what we can, but the patient, the person in the middle of it, is really the biggest advocate for themselves. And finding out those other advocates for them are going to be important in knowing what their resources are. Paul and Catherine, you both spoke to kind of finding that team of providers to help manage care and find resources and all of this. There were a couple questions that came up that spoke to that, about the difficulties in doing that. Specifically, there was a question, someone asking about their adult child with a 10-year history of ADEM from 10 years ago, saying how difficult it is to manage the neurologist and the urologist and the other providers that are necessary. And I know you speak to the importance of the team dynamic, and you might not be able to really answer this question, but I think many people would say that that's easier said than done. So I'm wondering, especially with these rare disorders, when there might not be a specialist in these disorders in their vicinity or even in their state, how do you have any tips or tricks or things to think about when it comes to putting a team together or managing interstate providers? Or things of that nature. How to best find the primary care provider to help facilitate the other kinds of care. Do you have any thoughts on that?
My one biggest thought, I would say, I completely understand that if the team is not already somewhat put into place, that as a looking from a patient perspective, this could be a huge task to take on to develop your team. So I guess my one piece of advice when starting it, as you're seeking out healthcare providers, I think the one key thing that they need to exhibit, they don't necessarily need to know and truly understand TM or NMO or ADEM, but they need to be able to truly listen to you as the patient and understand your concerns, your fears, and help navigate you to the right places. So it may be important just to have the first initial visit with any provider and ask kind of key questions of, are you going to partner with me and help me navigate through this course and advocate for me what I need a healthcare provider to advocate for? And I hate to say it, but if your overall sense is that they're not willing to do that, then that's probably not the right provider for you, and you need to look elsewhere. I know on the TMA website there are providers that are listed there that are more familiar with these rare disorders, so that can be a place to start as at least getting names of people who can be more resourceful for these patients. And then it's also reaching out to other patient advocacy groups and various Facebook groups and just asking the questions of, who have you found that has been able to work together in forming these care teams? The other side that I'll just throw out there is, you know, patients do have to advocate for themselves, and one way that's a very important way of advocating or highlighting the importance of having these care teams is to talk to your local and state representatives. Local and state government will listen better to the patient because you are their constituent versus if I reach out to them saying the need of helping to fund to put together such programs. They will listen to you more, and you reaching out to them is going to be more meaningful than me doing that. So I would really encourage patients to reach out to their state and even U.S. Federal representative and tell them that we need to be able to have these care teams put in place for patients with rare disorders.
Yeah, I think that's all very important to remember. It's not just medical resources that we have, but even some of these legal resources or governmental resources to help, you know, try to affect change a little bit. That can seem daunting or futile, but I think it's important that even a small, seemingly small thing can lead to larger repercussions if, you know, a lot of little small things come together. Catherine, do you have anything to add to that in terms of care coordination?
I realize this, it can be a really overwhelming navigating the healthcare system. I would encourage people to get summaries of care from their physicians and try to bring that to the different providers to try to keep everybody on the same page. You know, bring a list of your medications. You know, go to those appointments, bring a family or friend, a family member or friend to your appointments so that they can hear everything too, because sometimes you're seeing the visit trying to absorb things, but somebody could be there to take notes for you, just to help you remember, you know, everything that was discussed. I'm in that boat because I do it for my daughter and she sees multiple providers, but I just try to keep it all as organized as possible and see each of those people, and they're not all at the same facility either. So I think that's just when the patient or parent really needs to just kind of step in and try to keep those, get copies of your scans whenever you can, so you have those on hand when you're going to appointments and not trying to scramble to find them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go on, Catherine.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say that's all good advice, and I think what was that?
Well, I just want to say one more thing is that some of the most valuable resources I've learned about are from other parents who have a child with the rare illness that my child has that I would have never found out from otherwise. You know, I have found some amazing resources, so I would just say to network with other parents, other patients with the same illness. So, you know, they may know some wonderful resource that you don't know about, and vice versa.
Yes, that's, I think, very important. And one of the purposes of the TMA here is to really create that network, not only of like a hub to see what resources are available, what providers are there, educational materials that you can give to your provider as a patient, but also these networks, the Facebook groups, the support groups that are created under the auspices of the TMA for these connections to be made. I can, speaking to the Dallas-Fort Worth TM and NMO support group here, a lot of their meetings are just consist of roundtable discussions of what's worked for you, what hasn't worked for you, where do you go, how did you manage this, and those are, from speaking to them and being there, very valuable to them. So I think it's important to, again, like we've said here, it's not just looking at your doctor or your provider to answer all your questions. It's helping, it's finding the information from all the areas that could exist and then trying to condense that down with the help of your providers.
Yeah. And Sam, I just want to throw in this resource for parents. I'm so lucky here because we have school services at Children's that helps us out with educating the schools, and we have handouts for ADEM and limbic encephalitis and NMO and TM. But there, I came across this website. It's called understood.org, and it goes over all about 504 plans, about individual educational plans. I mean, a lot of things that you don't know about unless you have a child that needs these things. It has common accommodations. There's all kinds of articles on this website, and I think it would be really valuable for someone, especially maybe just starting and doesn't have somebody for school services to try to navigate that for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's important to remember. Especially the added layer of if you're a parent or guardian of a child with one of these disorders, or if you yourself are a college-age student and trying to figure out what accommodations you can have while you're in school, that's a whole other layer and a whole other area of resources that are available. Moving on a little bit, there are a number of questions that came in regarding kind of how to handle kind of pain and fatigue. They tended to go hand in hand in these questions in the long term after these diagnoses. Specifically, the questions came in about TM. And so the questions were really along the lines of, you know, I've do the physical therapy, do all the exercise, do the swimming, do the rehab, have done all of this, I'm in great shape, but there's still been years of constant pain. And that is obviously a concern and hard thing to handle. And of course, it can drive fatigue, can drive a lot of other issues. Could you speak to a little bit what to expect in terms of pain after these diagnoses, and then what are the options as to how to manage pain after TM or NMO or any kind of these demyelinating attacks?
Sure. I'm glad to hear one of the patients that submitted the question that they're doing all the exercise components that can help with pain. And so some people will seem like that's a backwards thought process of, I'm going to do exercise that can help with pain, but wouldn't that make it worse? And actually that's not true. So if you're able to do any type of physical activity, whether it's stretching or swimming or just even simply walking, that can actually help improve pain, and especially the fatigue component that can come with it also. And also just remember, this is not saying that you have to go out and do a hard 60 minutes of swimming, even if it's just simply 20 minutes a day, or you can break it up and have 10 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes in the afternoon. Getting out and having that physical activity will help immensely with managing the pain. If you're doing that and you're still having some pain that's interfering with your daily function, then there are different medications that can take, and I'm not recommending or saying that they're narcotic medications. There are a lot of different type of medications that we can use if patients have neuropathic pain. So if you're having pain that's causing you to have a lot of numbness or tingling in your extremities, there are different types of medication that we can use to help with that. a lot of the medications we use are old seizure medications or old anti-epileptic medications, but they work very well at controlling neuropathic pain. If you're having a pain that is more associated with muscle spasms, then you may want to talk to your provider to see if you can get in with someone to do Botox. So Botox can help relax the muscles, and it's an injection, of course, that you would go and get about every 3 months or so, but that can help also with the reduction in pain. And then there's other modalities that can help with pain, depending on the type of pain you're having. We will send a lot of our patients to our pain group who can do different types of injections to help with managing the pain as well. So it's tricky just to have one exact way to treat pain because there's just different ways of getting the pain controlled depending on the type of pain the patient is experiencing.
Mm-hmm. And, Catherine?
So I was just going to add a couple things that guided imagery has been shown to be really helpful in decreasing pain. I mean, there's been a lot of studies out there, and there's specific imagery. I mean, you can just Google it. There's a Health Journeys that's Bella Ruth Napersteck. She has so many different relaxation things like guided imagery for pain. And I know in the pain management program, they do a lot of biofeedback. And then this may kind of lead into another question, but I think that eating, having healthy eating skills is really important as far as pain control too. I listen to tons of podcasts myself, and the drive home message that I keep hearing over and over is that sugar can cause pain, sugar can cause anxiety, sugar can cause depression, and that's not just sugar, but processed foods as well. And just how important it is to eat real food and healthy fats, like olive oil, real butter, coconut oil, and incorporating lots of vegetables and protein into your diet, that really can have an impact.
Yeah, that's so true. And I'm going to predict that now that Catherine has mentioned about diet, that all of a sudden there's questions now coming up on what diet is recommended for patients with rare neuroimmunologic disorders. And the simple answer is there's not one. So the way we practice medicine is we look to the evidence and look for evidence-based medicine. And so unfortunately, from the nutrition standpoint, there hasn't been any well-controlled studies at looking at if you go on a dairy-free or if you go on a gluten-free diet, how does that impact TM or NMO or ADIM. But I do agree with Catherine, if you avoid the processed foods or you avoid foods high in sugar, my patients will report that overall they feel better, including their pain will actually improve with going to more of, it's the cliche, but the whole foods. So just your fresh fruits and vegetables, your lean protein, making it more of a balanced diet, can help with some of these symptoms as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you all touched on some of the questions that came up about diet. Before we kind of elaborate more on that, I'm glad that you talked about the pain management standpoint. I was thinking as you guys were talking about the pain management groups, many people when they think about pain and how to take care of it, think of the pharmacologic methods, narcotics, the other ways. Some people may think about, exercising and whatnot, but a lot of people don't think about the other forms that many pain management groups move into, which is more of the cognitive therapy aspect of it, and going that route and using those resources. So I think, and Catherine, you might be able to speak to this, either of you, about, going to a special therapist, a cognitive behavioral therapist, to help manage pain, long-term pain that might not be well controlled with diet, exercise, or medications. Could you speak to that for a moment?
Yeah, I mean, you're correct, Sam. We have several referrals for psychologists who specialize in pain management. So I think it is such an important piece of managing your pain is your emotional and mental well-being. because we know our mind can be so powerful over our bodies, and they definitely can implement, like I was saying, biofeedback and cognitive behavioral therapy. All of those things have been shown to help decrease pain. And just having someone there to coach you, and there's lots of coaches out there now, you know, coaching with nutritional coaching, personal training, coaching, there's all kinds of things out there, but there is psychologists who specialize specifically in pain management.
And the use of psychologists in pain management is starting to become more mainstream in your what I'll call your traditional pain management center. So I agree with you, Sam, that some people may have these faux pas when you say to go to pain management, thinking that they're just going to get a whole bunch of narcotics and have to come back every month to get that refilled. But a lot of pain management centers are actually developing these multidisciplinary approach where they can have you meet with a pain psychologist to do some of the cognitive behavioral therapy training to help change your response to either stressful situations or even sometimes just your response to when you can tell that you're starting to have pain. There is definitely some evidence out there to suggest that when you start having pain, there's a whole cascade that occurs mentally, and that could further exacerbate your pain. So the psychologist can work with you to retrain that thought process. In addition, they can have, whether it's PT or different modalities, work with you to work on the functional aspect of the pain as well.
Yeah. And I've heard some of our patients just say the physical therapy has been amazing in that regards. But, and Paul already brought this up, but just again to remember that transverse myelitis or whatever the rare illness is not always the reason, or it's not always the issue. And this came across just personally in my life. My husband has horrible feet pain, and he thought it was his diabetic neuropathy, which it could be, but he also found out he has plantar fasciitis in both feet horribly because he went to see a physical therapist for something else. So just know that, just don't assume you have to live with a symptom. Talk to your provider, and usually they'll be able to get to the bottom of it and try to figure out what's the best next course of action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's important to remember. Hit on that again, that it's, again, not always the chronic illness. There are other things that happen in life, and working with your care team to figure that out is important. With the conversation about diet, it sounds like from what you guys have said, especially you, Paula, that there's not necessarily a recommended type of diet, a fad diet, in order to, for these kinds of disorders, or how to handle the disorders in general. But just the general concept of healthy eating, you know, clean, trying to eat clean or unprocessed foods, low sugar, good fats, all of that. Do you have any thoughts about supplementation? I think of vitamin D and multiple sclerosis, or other kinds of supplements. There's a question that came in about turmeric or any of these other supplements, whether it be vitamin or otherwise, to help with aspects of neurological disease. Do you have any thoughts or insight into that?
Sure, and it's, you know, I hate to start off with saying that there's been no evidence to show, you know, improvement with things such as turmeric, because I know there's a lot of suggested information to say that it's anti-inflammatory, but there has been no proven studies to show that it will change a person's day-to-day symptoms with TM or ADEM or any of these other conditions. Whereas vitamin D gets a little bit tricky, and so, yes, we do have a lot of data, more of the MS patients, that vitamin D has, higher levels of vitamin D has been shown to decrease relapses, and so we are, you know, extrapolating that across to some of our NMO patients and patients with recurrent TM and some ADEM patients, but it's still, I would say, not 100% proven in these patient populations, just because it hasn't been truly studied. And so this is the frustrating part, where the science is probably behind the times of what patients are doing day to day. I tell my patients that they can, you know, take the turmeric, but I try and set the realistic expectations of it's not going to change your immune response to things. It's not immune suppressant or anything of that nature. However, if it helps you to feel better, if it helps you to feel your spasms are better, I don't see any problems with it. But I do just want to be clear of setting the expectations of with patients that it's these different foods and supplements aren't going to do anything to change the immune response, but they can definitely show some benefit into your day-to-day symptoms.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like the main thing with these, the takeaway is that we, because of the rarity of these disorders and the lack of you know, good, clean scientific evidence as to diets or supplementation or things of that nature, it can be a lot of trial and error. And remembering that there's not necessarily a cure-all panacea for any particular type of thing, but if it's something that you want to try and experiment with, see if it works for you as an individual, work with your provider to make sure there's not any long-term harm or damage that could be caused by it. It's fair, and it's something you can work with your provider with. Would that be a good summary, Paula?
That would be an excellent summary. Yes, thank you, Sam.
Great.
Sam, I was just thinking, oh, go ahead.
Oh, you go on, Catherine.
Okay, well, I was just thinking of one other thing that could increase or contribute to pain, and that is lack of sleep. And I think Paula was going to touch on that, just how important sleep is.
Yes, thank you for the reminder, Catherine. Now, that is so true. So everybody probably needs at least a good 6 to 8 hours of sleep. And so I give a range because I do think there are some people who can function normally on 6 hours of sleep. And there are going to be people who need to have a little bit more and have about 8 hours of sleep to function. If you're having interrupted sleep, either because you have the dog or cat in the bed with you, or you have a partner that's snoring, or the kids sneak in at the middle of the night and they kick you in the back, which might cause you to have some pain too, but impaired sleep can definitely affect, of course, fatigue is a given, but can affect your cognitive functioning, and it can make your pain seem as though it's worse just because you did not get a good restful sleep. So patients need to be mindful that one of the main purposes of sleep is to help repair and restore. So it's important to get in all the good cycles of sleep so the body can repair and restore itself. And so if your sleep is interrupted for various reasons, this could also be why you might feel like your symptoms are progressing or why things may be getting worse. So I always remind patients that, you know, you have to make sure you're practicing good sleep hygiene. And the first step is the purpose of the bed. The bed is, and everybody's going to blush when I say this, the purpose of the bed is for two things, sleep and sex only. So you're not supposed to read in bed. You're not supposed to have long discussions with your partner in bed. You're not supposed to watch TV in bed. You're only to get into bed when you're planning to go to sleep or have sex. And so when you're getting in the bed to go to sleep, you should just allow yourself to lay there for a few minutes. And if you haven't fallen asleep, you need to get out of the bed and do nothing that's going to stimulate the brain, but just something that's going to continue to help you to relax until you feel sleepy and then crawl back in the bed. And so there is some CBT or cognitive behavioral training that can be done with patients to help work on the sleep aspect, especially if you have problems falling asleep. Other pointers of good sleep hygiene is to make sure your bedroom is peaceful. So do whatever you need to do to make the bedroom feel like a serenity. So if it's putting up special curtains, or if it's having lavender scent in there, or if it's having it, if there's a color that helps to put you at peace, then these are the things you need to incorporate into the bedroom. You want to make sure when you're getting ready to go to bed that the bedroom is as dark as possible. If you have some type of outdoor light that is shining into the bedroom, you can purchase room darkening curtains to put out to help keep that light out. And the other thing is, you know, make sure that the pets and the kids and the husbands cooperate and not having the pets or the cats or the dog sleep in the bed with you. If your partner is snoring, send them to their own provider to get evaluated for that, so they can stop snoring or snore less, or you might have to think about using earplugs, just depending. The other key thing that patients will do is don't look at the clock if you wake up in the middle of the night. Avoid it, because that will further exacerbate your insomnia. And so if you wake up in the middle of the night, just try to go back to sleep, but don't look at the clock. If you feel like you're still not falling out of to sleep, then you should get out of the bed and either, you know, sit in a chair and read until you start to feel sleepy. I actually tell patients to try not to even keep a clock in their bedroom, because sometimes even the illumination of the clock can be enough to affect your normal sleep patterns. And it also means that maybe sometimes it's not a wise idea to have your cell phone near the bed either, because that also will give off a light if you're getting text messages throughout the night or different indications on your phone. It's going to light up, which can also impair your sleep. So there's various websites out there that can go through and give more detailed instructions for good sleep hygiene, but this is important in the overall management with any chronic condition.
Yeah, I think that's all important, the proper sleep hygiene, which there are tons of tips and tricks for that all over the place. Any provider should be able to discuss proper sleep hygiene and good sleeping practices for anybody in general. It can affect, like you said, fatigue, pain, cognitive thinking, and all of these things that can all exacerbate each other. Some questions that have come in as this conversation has been going on are about kind of issues that arise from TM and these disorders, like, you know, urinary issues through the night that wake you up, or spasms that wake people up in the middle of the night, and it's hard to get a good night's sleep. And I know that we only have about 5 minutes left, but maybe you can speak very briefly to that kind of hard question about how to best, or are there tips to balance that issue?
Sure. So real quickly, in regards to the bladder, you know, the first and easiest thing is to go to the bathroom before you get in the bed, and limit your liquid intakes about a couple hours before bedtime. And so if patients are already doing that, then the other step is to talk to your healthcare provider about different type of medications. There are actually some medications that can help alleviate the getting up to going to the bathroom at night. On the pain and spasm side, I find what works the best with that is to actually do some simple stretches right before you go to bed to help the muscles relax, and that seems to be able to alleviate the pain in the middle of the night. If patients are already doing that, once again, there are different medications that can be taken only at bedtime that can help decrease the number of spasms that may occur during the middle of the night that could further exacerbate or wake you up during the night.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. And hopefully that can help some people who have these issues. And I think you touched on things about, you know, bowel and bladder regimens, bowel and bladder programs that can help balance these things, and finding what best times to eat, best times to drink, best times to go to the bathroom prior to sleeping, and trying to make things as routine as possible can help with all of these things. In the last 5 minutes that we have here, I wanted to throw it out to you guys, Paula and Catherine, to each give us kind of a summary and overall kind of minute or so takeaway from this conversation today that you'd like for people to have. Catherine, would you like to start?
Sure. Well, I would just say that there's many strategies for healthy living. I think we talked about several, but just to find what works for you. And I think when people are faced with a devastating or chronic illness, that it really gives them the opportunity to prioritize what is really important in their life, and just kind of forget all the small stuff. Because, you know, I see people worry about small stuff in my life all the time that I think, wow, I wish that was all I had to worry about. But just to really prioritize what's important to you. Don't be afraid to say no. You're giving someone else an opportunity to be able to do whatever that is. So don't overload yourself where you're getting diminishing returns. And communicate to your team and your group and your family what works for you and what messes you up, because they are not walking in your shoes. They don't feel your invisible symptoms. They, you know, you just can't expect them to have an appropriate empathy that you think they should. And I just love this quote that is on the TMA website, which is, "Alone we can do so little, together we can do so much." And that was said by Helen Keller. I think that kind of sums it all up.
Yeah, that's a great quote. I agree completely with Catherine. I think the take-home message for patients with these rare disorders is to be your own advocate. Really communicate what you're feeling, what's going on with your family, your healthcare providers, your job, anyone that is, you know, you come in day-to-day contact with. And not everything is going to be your neurologic conditions. A lot of things influence the symptoms of your neurologic conditions. And so that's why it's important to have open, honest discussions with your healthcare providers. And so you have to also advocate and for yourself to say you know your own body and something is not right. And have your team work with you and not against you. I know it can get frustrating at times, but trust me, it definitely will pay off if you continue to advocate for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Thank you both for that. I appreciate, on behalf of the TMA and all of the community who's listening, yours, Paula and Catherine, your time and your expertise that you gave today. I want to remind everybody who's listening that this podcast has been recorded and will be on the TMA website, myelitis.org. There are a number of questions we weren't able to get to today, and I apologize for that. I hope that the heart of many of the questions were addressed here. I do also want to remind everybody that all of the podcasts that we've done over the last couple years are recorded and on myelitis.org, and there are a number of previous podcasts about a number of these issues, like pain and fatigue and cognitive issues and things that we've discussed here, some things that we weren't able to touch on very much. So I recommend, if you have further questions or want more details, the podcasts are a great resource for that. And everybody keep a lookout for the announcement for next month's podcast. And again, on behalf of the TMA, thanks everybody for listening. Have a good week.